The Hawaiian singer, Auntie Genoa Leilani Keawe, passed away yesterday at her home on the island of Oahu. She was 89.
A photograph, a calabash, a paper lace.
Keawe began performing her songs before World War II at officers' clubs and bandstands around Hawaii. She went on to record dozens of albums. It was her sweet falsetto in the song Alika that became her signature sound.
Keawe had cancer, and before she became too sick to perform, she'd been a mainstay every Thursday night at the Waikiki Beach Marriott Resort. This week, her 26-year-old granddaughter, Pomaikai, will replace her on stage and try to keep her traditional Hawaiian music alive.
If you go online, you can find free recordings from a world-famous concert violinist, Tasman Little. It's part of her effort to get classical music to the ears of mainstream listeners, as Rob Gifford reports from London.
It was clear from almost the first moment she picked up a violin at the age of 7 that Tasman Little had a special flair. Within a year, she was enrolled at the famous Yehudi Menuhin School just outside London, and her dazzling career as a concert violinist took off from there. But last month, she took the strange step of putting her latest recordings on the internet for free. Sitting in the front room of her house in West London, cradling her 1708 Stradivarius violin on her lap, she explains why she's doing it.
The simple answer is, it's about removing barriers. You can reach out to an audience that you could never physically get to. So it was about making something available, opening a door for people for free so that they can be introduced to a whole new world of music.
The first piece on the download is the Partita in E major by Johann Sebastian Bach. Tasman Little says it is among the most challenging works for solo violin, just the instrument on its own, stripped bare. As such, it epitomizes the feel and indeed the name of her whole project, which she has called the Naked Violin. But it's not just the classics that she's recorded and is offering up for free. There are pieces by the modern British composer Paul Patterson and by the early 20th century Belgian composer Eugène Ysaÿe. On the website of the Naked Violin, there's also a spoken introduction to accompany each piece and each composer, as well as some online tutorials for beginners.
The theme is centred around the two notes of A and D. So the first part of the theme goes something like this. Which is something of a question. There then follows a response.
The Naked Violin Project is more than just a free listen, though. Tasman Little just wants to get the violin, and classical music generally, out of the highbrow ghetto. So on her website, she lays down a three-step challenge.
The three steps are very simple. The first one is download the CD. The second one is get to know the music, because sometimes you can hear a piece for the first time and you don't really get it. Step three is use this as a means of getting to know more about classical music, buy a CD or come to a concert. And the final bit of step three is if you don't want to go to a concert, write and tell me why. What's the remaining barrier?
So far, Little says she's had lots of feedback and plenty of invitations to play. So this summer, she's taking her missionary zeal out to the places where people do not generally listen to classical music. A women's prison, an oil rig, various shopping malls and lots of schools. All part of trying to start a musical revolution with just one naked violin. Rob Gifford, NPR News, London.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Amber Collins is only 18 years old, but she's narrowed her career choices down to two possibilities, a singer or her backup, a cosmetologist. But she's faring well as a vocalist so far. She's been performing ever since childhood, though she says it wasn't until she discovered bluegrass music that she found her true voice. Amber says the bluegrass classic Ruby allows her and her band no speed limit to strut their stuff. Ruby, therefore, is the subject of today's segment in our What's in a Song series from the Western Folklife Center.
I'm Amber Collins from Saltville, Virginia. I'm 18 years old. And I play with the bluegrass band No Speed Limit. I hope to be doing this for a long, long time. I started singing when I was about 2. I just sang in church and things like that till I was about 8. And then I started to travel in competitions and things like that until I was about 14 or 15. My parents really pushed me, and it was something I wanted to do. But at one point, I sang at a different church every Saturday and Sunday. We went everywhere.
Ruby, honey, are you mad at your man?
And then I went to a bluegrass jam. Didn't think I liked the music until I got there, and it thrilled me and I took to it. There's so many different things you can do with a song, even a gospel song in bluegrass, and it's accepted. There's yodeling, and there's the notes that you hold out. You can do anything.
To get along with you, still you're not satisfied. Oh.
I feel that song so much. I love that song. I'd say that's one of my favorite songs that we do, just because you can be free with it, and it's not wrong. So I guess I'm just the kind of person, any kind of song you give me, I can find something that'll relate to it.
Ruby, honey, are you mad at your man?
I have a license in cosmetology. Other than that, I have no skills besides singing. I mean, that's all I've done almost my entire life. I feel like that's what I'm meant to do, whether it be in a church on Sunday morning every week or out here on the road like I'm doing now. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Ruby!
What's in a Song is produced by Hal Cannon and Taki Talanidis of the Western Folklife Center.
It's a depressing time for fans of No Depression. That's the name of an influential music magazine that will stop publishing this summer. It's one of many music magazines affected by the music industry's collapse. Some may return on the internet, but they will not be the same, as Joel Rose reports.
No Depression took its name from a song by the Carter family, a song that was picked up by the pioneering alt-country band Uncle Tupelo.
I'm going where there's no depression, to a better land that's free from care.
Uncle Tupelo's singer Jay Farrar was featured on the very first No Depression cover with his other band, Sun Volt. 13 years later, the magazine's subscription base is as big as it's ever been, and co-publisher Kyla Fairchild says newsstand sales are solid, too.
There's definitely no lack of demand for the product. It's really just a function of what's going on in the music industry.
Fairchild says the record labels that had always bought ads in the magazine just stopped buying them. She says the slide started last year, but it picked up speed in the last few months.
We were putting our March-April issue together, and that's usually our biggest issue of the year. And I couldn't even hit the ad number for that I had forecast for our smallest issues of the year.
Yet overall ad spending on magazines has been stable for the last 5 years. Postal rates and printing costs have gone up. But Nick Purdy, the publisher of the music magazine Paste, says the real killer is the loss of advertising from record labels.
If your business model is dependent on the record industry to pay the advertising bills, there is a change there. The business of music is changing dramatically.
CD sales have been declining for years, forcing record labels to tighten their belts. Bigger music magazines like Rolling Stone are more insulated from those changes because they have a larger readership and a more diverse advertising base. But just last month, the Christian music magazine CCM announced that it's closing its print edition. So did the indie rock magazine Resonance. If there's going to be a future for music magazines like these, it probably won't be on paper.
The newer model for niche-oriented music publications is going to be online.
Ann Powers writes about pop music for the Los Angeles Times. She says niche music sites could look very different from the magazines they used to be. They may have more in common with websites driven by fans and musicians.
These communities are based increasingly on interactivity between musicians and the fans. And the writer or the editor has to find her role in that. What is our role as mediators, as critics, as journalists?
That's a question the publishers of No Depression have asked themselves.
As I sort of envision the website, it would have a radio component, it would have a record store retail component, it would have user-driven chat rooms.
Kyla Fairchild says there's a potential downside to a site that's shaped by its users.
When you open things up to the public, you really can't complain when some horrible band puts something up. So there were concerns that it sort of diluted the value and what the brand stood for.
Nevertheless, Fairchild says she's determined to keep that brand going on the web. Paste magazine publisher Nick Purdy says other niche music magazines should be following her lead.
If you decide to focus purely on online, obviously you can reduce your costs and potentially survive. And you'll see a number of niche music publications eventually migrate to the web as purely digital publications.
Because he says the alternative isn't going to be viable for much longer. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Ever since I was a young teenager in music-mad Detroit, I've taken a radio to bed with me more consistently than another person, which is as much of a boast as it is a shamefaced confession.
It's our resident musician, David Was.
There is something comforting in knowing that my body is bathed in violins or blues songs, and not just the random noises of the night. I've always slept well and have Mozart and Muddy Waters to thank for it.
You got yawning, and I got funny.
My love affair with the radio began with the under-blanket transistor AM portable, and now has quantum leaped to the standalone Phoenix Wi-Fi internet radio, which pulls in every station from Algeria to Japan.
To MandarinRadio.com.
Anything that streams via a web browser, but without the need for a computer.
La radio de Seb.
Like satellite radio, this is an invention I dreamed of in high school. A radio you could tune to anything from Indian ragas to Hank Williams any time of day or night.
How's about cooking something up with me?
Well, the future is upon us, and it's impossible to imagine turning or tuning back. Right now, a spin of the Wi-Fi dial takes me from France's Wii FM,
le bureau des productions indépendantes de Wii FM,
to Germany's darker radio. And Pashto radio out of India is blowing some garish Bollywood soundtrack noise. You can also listen to podcasts or comedy routines, all without loading a web page or installing a player. Wait a few seconds for the station to buffer, and you're on your way to a brave new world of content on demand, from talk radio to techno, mariachis to Mantovani. I suppose a French existentialist like Jean-Paul Sartre would frown upon such an expansive menu, choice being our undoing as moderns. But was it better to have been hemmed in by the hegemony of program directors and DJs back in the medium's so-called golden age? Back then, the records that made the airplay charts were often as not subject to the back-alley influence of mob-connected bagmen who delivered TV sets and envelopes full of $100 bills, along with the latest candidate for a hit single. That system is still alive and well in commercial radio, despite Elliot Spitzer's attempts to rein in the payola game in New York State. The late 60s in a great cultural melting pot like Detroit did give rise to what was known as freeform radio, with old hippie DJs playing anything they dang well pleased, from the endless drum bashing of Inagata DeVita to Dylan's prolix poetics on a song like Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. Now genre mattered less than vibe, even if that meant playing Miles Davis and Captain Beefheart back to back. There was a new democracy afoot in what had been an advertising-driven, corruption-influenced medium. Now, the diametrically opposite trend has taken hold. With the seemingly infinite real estate of broadband, one can tune in a station called Beethoven Only and prove that man can indeed live on Ludwig alone.
David Was is a radio devotee and half of the musical duo Was Not Was.
George Gershwin's American in Paris, soon to be performed by an American orchestra in Pyongyang, the New York Philharmonic, which performs in the North Korean capital tomorrow. No doubt there will be much examination of the political implications of this unprecedented visit, and we thought we'd hear a little bit about the musical implications of it from music critic Tim Page. Hello, Tim.
Hi, it's good to talk to you.
Now, the Philharmonic is going to play Gershwin, Dvorak's New World Symphony, Wagner's Prelude to Act 3 of Lohengrin, and they have a Korean folk song prepared as an encore. What does that program say to you?
Well, it's a fairly conventional program, but considering all the additional baggage that's going on here, it seems to me that it's a good way of programming. It strikes me as a nice calling card for the largest and oldest orchestra in America to bring to a very, very new audience.
You think that in a let's break the ice after more than half a century concert, not the moment to play Pierre Boulez or something like that?
Probably not, although I imagine there are probably some Koreans who just love to hear some Pierre Boulez, because some of this music, I can imagine, may be permitted by the government. I suspect, yes, there'll probably be more people who respond to this than Pierre Boulez.
Are these signature pieces of the New York Philharmonic?
I think they're signature pieces for any orchestra. I mean, they're all played a fair amount. The Lohengrin is a great and an exciting encore, which has been used in so many different films. It's fast moving. It's got great melodies. You know, it's that one. Da 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 bum bum
ba dum bum. This is a little bit that we'll hear of the Seattle Symphony playing the Wagner music from Lohengrin.
And, American in Paris, Gershwin is very popular and very American, and you can do this without a piano soloist, so you don't have to, lug a piano over there. So it's, probably one of his two or three most popular, orchestral compositions.
That would be a consideration, that if you were to play a piano piece, let's say, you would have to add to all the other complications of this trip handling of a piano.
Absolutely. And anytime you're planning an orchestral tour, that's a big question. Do we bring a pianist? Do we bring a soloist who carries her own instrument? I mean, what exactly do we do? It sounds like the sort of concert that, frankly, if I were still reviewing music in Washington, that wouldn't exactly get my heart a-fluttering too much. But, I mean, for people who've been kind of musically landlocked for so long, it strikes me as a nice calling card.
Not setting your heart aflutter. I think I can read the imaginary lead in my mind, which is it's all all old war horses they're putting on if it were playing for an American audience.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, but you know, there's a time and a place for old war horses. And I mean, this is kind of musical politics light, but I think that's probably what's called for in such a case. And, you know, I know there's been some disagreement among some critics and some people who are writing about music, but I can't see how this is going to hurt anything.
Tim Page, thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Music critic Tim Page spoke to us from Los Angeles, where he is a visiting professor at the University of Southern California.